Welcome to Nocturnal Tales. Tonight, Poirot and Hastings find themselves at a country lodge, where a weekend of cards, laughter, and romance soon turns to something darker. Pride and jealousy are dealt into the game, and before long, the stakes are life itself. This is A Game of Hearts, an original mystery written by us in homage to Agatha Christie and her immortal detective, Hercule Poirot. Its inspiration comes from the infamous Murder of William Ware, a real case that shocked Regency England and became one of its most notorious gambling crimes. Before we begin, tell us in the comments, where in the world are you listening from tonight? It delights us to see our community of mystery lovers growing across the globe, and I'm so grateful for the thoughtful feedback and kind words you share. Producing these tales, the writing, narration, and illustrations, takes many hours, and your support helps keep them alive. You can join our membership for ad-free listening and exclusive content, or leave a small tip. But even if that isn't possible, simply listening, commenting, and sharing is already a generous gift that keeps Nocturnal Tales flourishing. Now, let the story unfold. Chapter 1. An Invitation to Wealden Lodge. It is one of the peculiarities of my friendship with Hercule Poirot that, whenever I am most certain life has at last become quiet and predictable, he will suddenly plunge us both into the heart of an affair as strange as any novelist could contrive. This truth was borne upon me most forcibly one crisp March morning, when a chance encounter at my club led directly to what Poirot afterwards called l'affaire Wealden. I had gone up to the smoking room after breakfast, idly scanning the papers, when a familiar hail startled me. "Hastings, old chap! By Jove, it is you!" It was Reginald Frobisher, tall, hearty, ruddy of cheek, the sort of fellow who looks as though he had been born to wear riding boots. I had known him slightly in the army and seen him since at the club, always in connection with some new sporting enthusiasm. He had once tried to teach me fly fishing with little success, and last I heard he had taken up both boxing and poker with equal vigor. "Doing anything this weekend?" he demanded, thumping me on the back with unnecessary energy. "Nothing of note," I admitted. "Splendid. Then you must come down to Wealden Lodge, my uncle's place in Hertfordshire. Bit of a shoot, bit of cards in the evening. Some rather interesting guests. Bring your Belgian fellow along. Hercule Poirot, isn't it? Heard a lot about him. Would be dashed fun to have him down." I laughed. "I'm not sure country weekends are quite in Poirot's line, Reggie. He's not a hunting man." "Rubbish. Tell him there's hot water, electric light, and as much central heating as he could wish for. We'll make him comfortable. Only do come. We want a full house." And with that he bustled off, leaving me half amused, half intrigued. That evening at Whitehaven Mansions I broached the matter to Poirot. He was engaged in trimming the wick of a candle, an affectation of his, for the room had perfectly good electric light. "Mon cher Hastings," he said, peering at me over his magnificent moustaches, "you look as though you have a secret. Confess." I related Frobisher's invitation. Poirot listened without interruption, his head a little on one side like a bird considering a crumb. "Poker, Hastings? Always it is the poker I do not approve." He twirled the tips of his moustache. "It is not the game of logic, but of chance. And chance, she is like a woman, charming but untrustworthy." "Oh, come now, Poirot. It will be good sport, and a weekend in the country might do you good." He raised his eyebrows to the ceiling. "The country, Hastings. Mud on the shoes, draughts in the corridors, and worst of all, the English habit of overcooking the vegetables. Mon Dieu, they boil the life out of the poor carrot until it dies of boredom. But still..." His eyes narrowed. "Tell me, who will be present?" I confessed I did not know. Reggie hinted at an interesting crowd. Perhaps some boxing friends of his. And I dare say one or two ladies. Ah, Poirot's eyes twinkled. Ladies, you say? Already it is more promising, for where there are men who gamble and ladies who smile, there also may be passion. And where there is passion, Hastings, there may be crime. He tapped the candlewick with satisfaction. We will go. And so it was that the following Saturday found us rattling out of London in a motor hired for the purpose. Poirot sat beside me, muffled in his greatcoat, his small figure looking oddly fragile against the deep cushions. "Observe, Hastings," he said, gesturing with one delicate hand as the autumn fields rolled by. "The English countryside. To you it is charming. To me it is the grave of order. The boots come back caked with mud. The wind sneaks in under the door. The hay gives one the sneezes. Enfin! But where men pretend to seek sport, often they pursue something else entirely." Wealden Lodge, when we reached it, was a rambling house of red brick, standing a little apart from the village. It had an air of comfortable neglect, the sort of place where dogs were welcome on the chairs and the smell of cigars clung to the curtains. Reggie greeted us with exuberance. "Hastings! And Monsieur Poirot! Capital, capital! You'll find the others in the drawing-room." The others proved to be a curious assortment. There was Sir George Bartlett, a retired sporting baronet with a booming laugh. Lionel Wade, a smooth fellow in evening dress, already shuffling a pack of cards with professional skill. Miss Violet Glenn, dark-eyed, striking, with the sort of smile that suggests amusement at one's expense. And finally, a tall, fair man introduced as Charles Linton, whose manner to Miss Glenn was markedly attentive. I confess my sporting instincts were stirred at once. Here, I thought, was a fine company for a weekend of cards and companionship. But Poirot, settling himself in an armchair, surveyed the group with eyes that missed nothing. "Curious," he murmured to me later when Reggie had bustled off to see about dinner. "Already I perceive undercurrents. Monsieur Wade, he shuffles the cards too easily. Comme un professionnel. Mademoiselle Glenn? She is admired by two, perhaps three men. And admiration, Hastings, can be more dangerous than debt." I laughed. "You surely don't expect murder at a weekend party?" Poirot smiled. "My friend, I expect nothing, I observe. And I tell you this, before this weekend is finished, there will be drama at Wealden Lodge." As usual, he was right. Chapter 2. The Cards on the Table. Dinner at Wealden Lodge was hearty in the extreme. Soup, a magnificent roast, puddings of alarming richness, and a cheeseboard that might have provisioned a regiment. Sir George Bartlett praised every dish at top volume. Reggie Frobisher kept us amused with accounts of his boxing bouts. Knocked him clean through the ropes, by Jove. While Lionel Wade, smooth as silk, spoke little, but smiled in a manner that gave the impression he was inwardly correcting everyone else. Miss Violet Glenn was placed between Sir George and Charles Linton. She endured the baronet's booming compliments with graceful indifference, but she turned to Linton now and then with quiet, attentive remarks, and once or twice I saw her smile at him with a warmth absent from her dealings with the others. Linton himself, ordinarily a rather reserved fellow, grew visibly brighter in her company. Poirot, across the table from me, ate with small, delicate movements, as though each bite had been weighed and approved. He murmured something about the cabbage being murdered, but otherwise maintained a courteous silence, his eyes darting from one guest to another. When at last we returned to the drawing-room, cigars were brought out and brandy offered. Sir George enveloped the room in smoke, Miss Glenn requested coffee, and Lionel Wade produced, as though it had been expected all along, a neat pack of cards from his breast pocket. "Poker, eh?" cried Sir George. "That's the game." Miss Glenn reclined languidly. "You men and your cards, always so sure of yourselves, until the luck turns." "Luck, Miss Glenn?" Wade smiled, cutting the pack with effortless grace. "A man makes his own luck. At cards, as in life." "Not always," Linton interjected quietly. His eyes flicked to hers, then back to Wade. Sometimes the game is stacked before one sits down. Do I detect an accusation? Wade's smile widened. Linton flushed. Not at all. Only an observation. Sir George chuckled. Well, let's see whose observation pays tonight, eh? We gathered round the table. Poirot declined to play, pleading fatigue, but positioned himself nearby, watching. The first hands were harmless enough. Reggie cursed when he lost. Sir George roared with laughter at his own blunders, and Miss Glenn drifted over from her chair now and then to lean lightly on the table, her presence plainly unsettling both Linton and Wade. "You should play, Miss Glenn," said Wade smoothly, after a round in which he had raked in a tidy little heap of coins. She shook her head, her dark eyes glinting. "No, I prefer to watch. Men reveal more when they think a woman isn't looking." "And what do you see?" Wade asked. "That you play as though you're certain of winning," she replied, "and that Mr. Linton plays as though he's afraid of losing." There was a ripple of amusement. Linton coloured but said nothing. Poirot leaned towards me. "You observe, Hastings?" "Mademoiselle, she strikes at the pride of both men. It is deliberate." "Deliberate?" I whispered. "She's only teasing." Poirot's moustaches twitched. "Teasing, yes, but with precision. It is like fencing. A little cut here, a little cut there. Such things can wound deeply." The play grew more serious. Wade dealt with professional smoothness, his eyes never leaving the others. Sir George blustered good-naturedly, losing steadily. Reggie grew excited, slapping the table and exclaiming whenever he won a pot. Linton, by contrast, grew paler and tighter-lipped, until finally came the hand that would decide the evening. The betting rose sharply between Wade and Linton. Sir George had folded, Reggie too. Linton's hand trembled as he pushed forward his coins. He glanced once at Miss Glenn. She met his eyes and gave him the faintest nod. "I'll see you," he said. The cards went down. Wade's hand was strong. Linton's was stronger still. There was a small silence, then Sir George slapped his thigh. "Bravo, lad! Beat him fair and square!" Reggie let out a whoop. Wade's expression hardly changed, but his eyes narrowed ever so slightly. "Well played," he said softly. "A bold gamble. One day it may cost you more than you realize." The words were courteous enough, but the edge beneath them was unmistakable. Later, when the others had gone up to bed, I commented to Poirot, "Pretty bit of luck for Linton, eh?" Took Wade down neatly. "Luck." Poirot shook his head. "Non, mon ami. It was courage. And courage is not summoned for shillings. He risked all because of a glance from Mademoiselle Glenn. That was the true stake at the table tonight." I laughed. "You're reading romance into everything, Poirot." "Romance?" His eyes twinkled. "Perhaps. But where men gamble for a woman's smile, Hastings, there is always danger. Mark me. We have seen only the first deal of the game. Before the weekend ends, the final card will be played, and it may not be pleasant." I went up to bed, half amused at his melodrama. Yet even then I could not quite shake off a sense of unease, as though the smoke of Wade's cigar still lingered in the air, acrid and ominous. Chapter 3. Death in the Lane. The morning at Wealden Lodge dawned with a grey sky and a thin mist clinging to the hedgerows. I came down early, for years of army life have made me a bad sleeper in strange beds. The great hall smelled of polish and damp tweed. A sleepy maid was laying the breakfast table. Sir George appeared in tweeds of astonishing check, booming for kippers before the clock had struck eight. Reggie followed in breeches and gaiters, full of enthusiasm for a morning shoot. Lionel Wade drifted in later, immaculate as ever, as though his tie had been laid by a valet, which perhaps it had. Poirot came last, stepping delicately into the room as though he mistrusted the carpet. We were only just beginning our meal when Reggie frowned. "Where's Linton?" He was to join us for the shoot. Sir George snorted. Overslept, these young fellows, no stamina. But Miss Glenn entered at that moment, her dark eyes a little troubled. I knocked at his door. No answer. Wade smiled faintly. Perhaps he found last night's excitement too much for him. Poirot looked up sharply. Excitement, monsieur? His lucky hand, Wade replied smoothly. Not everyone wins so boldly against me. Perhaps he is sleeping off his triumph. The maid confirmed that Mr. Linton's bed had not been slept in. That caused a stir. Well, dash it, said Reggie. He can't have gone far. Let's have a look round before we set out. It was agreed that we should search. Sir George led the way with noisy determination, while Miss Glenn followed with anxious quickness. Poirot, muffled in his great coat, walked beside me, his eyes intent on the ground. We had gone perhaps half a mile down a narrow lane, hedged with dripping hawthorn, when we came upon a dreadful sight. Charles Linton lay sprawled against the bank, his coat muddy, his face chalk white beneath the fair hair. One arm was twisted unnaturally, and there was a dark stain upon his waistcoat. Miss Glenn gave a little cry and turned her face away. Sir George muttered, "Good God!" and bent clumsily, but Poirot was quicker. He knelt beside the body, his fingers precise, examining without touching. "Dead?" I asked hoarsely. Poirot looked up. "Yes, quite dead." "Hastings, fetch no one nearer. Let us preserve what remains." Reggie exclaimed, "Murder, then." "Poor chap. Who could have done this?" The question hung in the mist like gunpowder smoke. We bore the body back to the house under a sort of stunned silence. A gardener was dispatched to telephone for the police, though it would be some time before they arrived. Meanwhile, the guests were gathered in the drawing room, their faces drawn, their voices hushed. Poirot stood very still, regarding them. Then, one by one, he spoke softly. "Sir George, you were the first into the lane. You saw nothing unusual before we found him?" "Nothing. Only a rook taking wing. I thought it odd he should be lying there, that's all." "Poor devil." "Reggie!" Reggie shook his head. "We were all together. He can't have fallen. The look of him, that was no accident." "Miss Glenn?" She trembled. "I cannot believe it. He was alive, laughing only last night. Why would anyone—" Her voice broke. Poirot's eyes lingered on her. "Indeed, why, mademoiselle?" And then to Wade. "Monsieur!" Wade's expression was grave, but curiously controlled. "It is a tragedy. But if you ask me, the answer is obvious. He won money at cards last night. A country lane, a dark hour, a man carrying winnings in his pocket, and robbery, pure and simple." "Ah," said Poirot softly. "You think so?" "Robbery?" "Yes, what else?" Poirot's eyes glinted. "Many things, monsieur. Many things besides." There was silence. Sir George puffed his cheeks. Reggie looked bewildered. Miss Glenn clasped her hands tightly in her lap. Poirot began to pace, small neat steps across the carpet. "This morning, Hastings, we set out for a sporting day, but instead of the birds of the air we found the body of a man." "What is sport, after all?" "A contest. And last night there was a contest at this very table. One man triumphed, another was humiliated. And the prize? Was it money, or was it something more dangerous still?" He looked at Miss Glenn, whose eyes flashed with sudden defiance, then at Wade, who met his gaze smoothly, finally at Sir George, whose ruddy face grew redder. "Mon Dieu," Poirot said softly, "this is not the affair of a few shillings lost and won. There is more here, much more." And though the fire crackled and the brandy stood ready on the sideboard, the room seemed colder than the misty lane outside, and every one of us felt it. Chapter 4. Below the Surface. Poirot had chosen the morning room for his inquiries. It was a long, low chamber with faded hunting prints, a faint smell of polish, and an excellent fire in the grate. He arranged himself at a writing desk as though it were a judge's bench, his small form precise, moustaches gleaming, hands folded. I had my notebook ready, though Poirot wagged a finger at me. "Always you write, Hastings. But remember, the facts, they are only half the story. Tone, hesitation, contradiction, those are the shadows in which truth hides. Still write, it pleases you." I had my notebook at the ready, though I doubted my ability to record all the subtleties he spoke of. Still, I resolved to do my best. The butler entered gravely, as if attending a funeral. "Mr. Linton left the house just after midnight, sir. Without his coat, he looked troubled. Walked into the fog."
"You thought it strange?"
"Yes, sir, but it is not my place to comment." Poirot's eyes gleamed. "And yet you did think it strange, n'est-ce pas?" The man inclined his head slightly. "Yes, sir." The parlour-maid, pale and nervous, twisted her apron. "I saw Miss Glenn in the corridor then, sir. She had a shawl, and she looked upset."
"Merci, mademoiselle," Poirot said gently. "You have sharp eyes."
The gardener, cap in hand, reported simply, "Heard voices in the lane, sir. Two men, Rowan Fierce, one voice like Mr. Wade's, can't swear, but it sounded like him."
Poirot thanked him gravely. "Très bien, that will do."
When the man had gone, Poirot turned to me with a small nod. "You see, Hastings, the quarrel was not imagination. Two men entered the fog. Only one returned." I shivered. Sir George was the first of the guests to appear, filling the doorway with his broad shoulders and booming indignation. He seated himself heavily, spreading his tweeds about him like a tent. "Dashed bad business, Poirot, never seen the like. Young fellow cut down in his prime. Disgusting, that's what it is."
"You liked Mr. Linton, then?" Poirot asked softly.
"Liked him?"
"Yes, why not? Decent chap. Rode fairly well when I saw him at a meet last season. Quiet sort. Didn't make a song and dance of himself. Good breeding in that."
Poirot nodded. "You played cards with him last night."
"Eh?
Oh, yes. Sat in on a few hands. I'm no dab hand, mind you. Lost a bit, laughed it off. That's the way."
"And what of the others?"
"Wade's the one to watch. Plays like a professional. Shuffles the pack as if he were born with cards in his fingers. Too smooth for my taste."
"You thought him dangerous?"
"Dangerous? I wouldn't go so far, but I didn't like the look on his face when Linton beat him. Smiling, yes, but the wrong kind of smile. I've seen it in the hunting field when a fellow takes offense badly and another rides past him clean. Looks pleasant enough, but you can tell he'd like to throttle you."
"Très bien," said Poirot, twirling his moustaches. "You think, then, the quarrel lay between Linton and Wade?"
Sir George harrumphed. "If there was a quarrel, yes, but you won't get me to accuse the man outright. I speak as I find. That's all."
"Merci, Sir George. You have been most helpful."
Reggie bounded in next, all youthful energy and agitation. He perched on the edge of the chair, his gaiters still muddy from the lane. "Ghastly thing, Poirot. Can't get it out of my head. Poor old Charles lying there in the ditch. Never thought I'd see the like."
"You were fond of him, perhaps?"
"Liked him tremendously. Quiet chap, but decent. Could hold his own at cards, too, though he wasn't flashy. That was what I liked about him. He wasn't out to make fools of the rest of us like Wade."
Poirot's eyes gleamed.
"Ah, you think Mr. Wade set out to humiliate others?"
Reggie nodded vigorously.
"That's it. He plays to win, of course, but more than that, to crush, to prove he's cleverer. Linton beat him fair and square last night, and I'll wager Wade didn't like it one bit." "And yet, monsieur, sometimes it is not money that stings the most, but a smile. Did you notice how Mademoiselle Glenn looked at Linton?"
Reggie flushed.
"Yes, I noticed. Everyone did. She all but told him to go for it. He risked everything because she was watching. Damned romantic, if you ask me."
"And Wade noticed, too."
"Of course he did. You could see it in his eyes. But look here, Poirot. Violet Glenn isn't worth killing a man for."
"Ah, but who decides the worth of a woman, mon ami? Not logic. Never logic."
Poirot waved a hand.
Merci, Monsieur Frobisher. That will do. Lionel Wade entered with composed elegance, as if he had been summoned to a drawing-room rather than an inquiry. He sat with deliberate ease, one ankle resting on his knee, his hands folded over it. A sad business, Monsieur Poirot, but I dare say the solution is simple. Linton carried his winnings in his pocket. He left the house late. Some village ruffian saw his chance. Robbery, pure and simple.
You are certain it was robbery? Poirot asked. Wade smiled. Is it not obvious? His pockets were empty.
Obvious things, Poirot said gently, are often arranged to look so. Tell me, monsieur, what did you feel when you lost to Mr. Linton last night?
Nothing at all, Wade replied smoothly. Cards are cards. Sometimes one wins, sometimes one loses.
Poirot's eyes sharpened. And yet your hand trembled, very slightly, when you laid down your cards. You smiled, yes, but it was the smile of a man who swallows something bitter.
For the first time, Wade's composure faltered. I dislike losing, certainly, but that is no crime.
No crime, no. But humiliation, monsieur, is a motive as old as Cain, and last night it was not only the cards that humiliated you, it was the glance of a woman.
Wade's face hardened.
You mean Violet. She is free to smile at whomever she pleases.
Spoken like a philosopher, Poirot said softly. And yet, monsieur, the gardener heard raised voices in the lane, one of them like yours.
Wade's eyes narrowed. The gardener imagines things in fog voices carry.
He may have heard two men, yes, but not I. I was in my room.
Alone?
Alone. Poirot bowed slightly. Merci, monsieur, you have said enough.
When Violet Glen entered, the atmosphere changed. She wore a dark wrap, her face pale, her eyes brilliant with suppressed emotion.
Must we go through this performance, Monsieur Poirot? Charles is dead. Leave it at that.
Poirot's tone softened.
Alas, mademoiselle, the dead cannot rest until truth is known. You were fond of him?
Yes.
Her voice trembled, then steadied.
I loved him, if you must know. He was kind, and he listened. That may not sound much, but in a world of men who boast, it meant everything.
Poirot inclined his head.
And yet you encouraged him to play last night. Why?
He doubted himself. He thought he could not win. I wanted him to see he could, that he was strong.
You gave him courage with a glance that Wade did not miss.
She lifted her chin.
Let him be jealous, then. I never gave Wade encouragement.
And yet you fear him, Poirot murmured.
Her eyes flashed. I fear no man. But I tell you this, Charles feared something. He said to me only last night, if anything happens to me, remember it was not the cards that ruined me.
Then he laughed, as though it were a jest, but I saw the look in his eyes. He meant it.
Poirot's gaze sharpened. Très intéressant. You have given me the key, mademoiselle.
When the last of them had gone, Poirot leaned back, fingers steepled, eyes half shut.
Well, Hastings, and what do you conclude?
That Wade killed him, I said promptly. He was jealous of Miss Glen, angry at losing. The quarrel in the lane proves it. It all fits.
Poirot smiled. Ah, Hastings, you leap like the hound to the wrong scent.
The quarrel, yes, but remember what Linton said. It was not the cards that ruined me.
Non, mon ami. The truth is elsewhere. The crime is not of money, it is of the heart.
He rose, eyes bright as steel.
One more act remains. We must bring them together, all of them, for it is time to lay the final cards upon the table.
Chapter 5. The Truth in the Garden. It was Poirot's command, not suggestion, that brought us all together. At 3:30, we assembled on the terrace of Wealdon Lodge, overlooking the autumn gardens where the roses hung brown and sodden, and the lane wound away into the mist.
The air was chill and every face seemed paler than usual. Sir George loomed in his checks, Reggie flushed and restless, Wade smooth as marble, Miss Glen white but defiant. Even the butler lingered discreetly at the French doors, and the gardener shuffled awkwardly with cap in hand. Poirot stood before us, immaculate, his shoes gleaming despite the damp stones. He looked from one to another as a general might survey his troops.
"My friends," he began in precise tones, "we are not here merely to mourn a tragedy. We are here to understand it. Charles Linton is dead. The police will come, yes. But before they do, I must know what happened in this house, in these gardens, in that lane."
A silence fell. Sir George cleared his throat. Reggie shifted from foot to foot. Miss Glen clasped her hands tightly. Wade alone seemed calm. "Already we have heard theories," Poirot continued. "Sir George speaks of robbery. Mr. Wade also. Mademoiselle Glen believes it jealousy. Hastings," he inclined his head towards me, "is certain it was Wade himself, but I tell you, appearances deceive. Always they deceive." He turned suddenly to Sir George. "You said this morning you noticed nothing unusual, yet just now you mentioned a rook taking wing in the lane. Why did you not tell me that before?" Sir George blustered. "A rook's nothing. Birds fly at shadows." "On the contrary," Poirot replied, "a rook rises when disturbed."
"By whom, Sir George?
By a man lying in wait, or by two men in anger?" The baronet reddened. "I don't know. Don't press me, sir." Poirot merely inclined his head, then swung to Reggie. "You admired Charles Linton, yes?" Reggie brightened. "Of course I did. Straight sort of fellow." "And yet you spoke warmly of Violet Glen's admiration for him. Are you quite sure, monsieur, that admiration did not awaken envy in you?" Reggie flushed. "That's not fair. I liked him. Yes, Violet cared for him. Anyone could see it. But I never wished him harm. I swear it." Miss Glen turned her head sharply at that, her eyes unreadable. Poirot's gaze passed to Wade. "You, monsieur, are most insistent upon robbery. Why so?"
"Because it is plain," Wade answered smoothly. "His winnings gone, his pockets empty. What other explanation is there?"
Poirot's moustaches quivered.
"Ah, but a true robber takes all. Yet Linton's watch was untouched. Does that not strike you as strange?"
For the first time, Wade's smile faltered.
"Perhaps the thief was disturbed."
"Perhaps," Poirot said. "And yet the gardener heard two voices quarreling in the lane. One was like yours." Wade's eyes chilled. "Peasant imaginations. Fog plays tricks."
"Fog does not argue, monsieur," Poirot returned sharply.
"Men do." He turned to Violet Glen.
"You told me something most curious, mademoiselle, that Charles said to you, 'If anything happens to me, remember it was not the cards that ruined me.'
What did he mean?"
She bit her lip.
"I don't know. He was troubled. He would not tell me more."
"You are sure?"
Her eyes flashed.
"What are you implying, that I knew his fears and kept them back? I would never betray him."
Poirot's tone softened. "And yet betrayal, it is a word that recurs to me." At that moment the gardener, twisting his cap, coughed nervously. "Begging your pardon, sir. There's summat I didn't say before. After the voices I heard footsteps. Two men walking away side by side. Then later only one coming back."
A hush fell. Poirot's eyes gleamed. "You hear, Hastings? Two men went into the fog, one returned alone. That tells us the quarrel was no accident. Linton walked knowingly beside the one who killed him."
The words struck like stones dropped in a pond. Sir George muttered. Reggie gave a low exclamation. Violet went very white. Wade stared straight ahead, his smile frozen in place. Poirot drew himself up, surveying us all. "And now, mes amis, you see the pattern. Charles Linton did not die for cards, nor for money. The pockets were emptied to deceive, nothing more. He died for something older, stronger, more dangerous, for pride, for jealousy, and perhaps for love. No one spoke. The mist pressed close about the terrace, and the air felt heavy with unspoken things. Poirot raised a finger. Patience, I do not yet accuse, but tonight, before the day is done, I will bring you all together once more. Then, mes amis, the final card shall be turned, and the truth will stand revealed. We dispersed slowly, each to our corners of the house. I walked beside Poirot, my mind seething. Poirot, I whispered, you are certain. It was Wade, wasn't it? He gave me a little smile. Always you jump, Hastings. Perhaps Wade. Yes, perhaps another. But remember this. In murder, the true motive is seldom money. It is the heart that betrays. And in matters of the heart, ah, there lies the danger. And with that enigmatic remark, he left me to my thoughts, which were no less confused than the mist that cloaked the garden. Chapter 6. The Last Card. We were summoned once again to the drawing room after supper. The fire glowed, casting tall shadows upon the panelled walls. The atmosphere was taut as wire. Each of us had played our part in the long, uneasy day, but it was clear we now awaited judgment. Poirot stood by the hearth, his small figure immaculate, his fingertips pressed together, his eyes shining with quiet certainty. "My friends," he began, "the moment has come to place the last card upon the table. This morning you found Charles Linton dead in the lane. At first glance it seemed robbery. His pockets were empty. But the pockets, ah, they were emptied to deceive. The true cause was not money, but something far older and more powerful." He turned slightly, his gaze sweeping over us. "Always I ask myself, who profits? Not in pounds and shillings, but in the heart. Monsieur Wade, you had pride and you had jealousy. You lost to Linton at cards. More, you lost to him in the eyes of Mademoiselle Glenn. You quarrelled with him in the lane. All this makes you the obvious suspect." Wade stiffened, but said nothing. Poirot lifted a finger. "But the obvious it deceives. You, Wade, spoke too much of robbery. You shouted it at every turn. That alone tells me you are not the man. A guilty one says little. It is the innocent who protest too much." There was a stir. Sir George looked bewildered. Reggie muttered, "Well, dash it, if not Wade, then who?" Poirot turned to Violet Glenn. She sat very still, her hands clasped tightly, her eyes fixed on the carpet. "Mademoiselle," Poirot said softly, "Charles Linton was in love with you, that is plain. And you too cared for him. You have admitted as much. But he feared something, did he not? He told you, 'If anything happens to me, remember it was not the cards that ruined me.' What did he mean?" Her lips trembled. "I don't know," she whispered. "But I know," Poirot said gently. "He meant that it was not debt or gambling that threatened him, but love itself. He was caught, was he not, in a triangle of the heart? Between you, mademoiselle, and another?" He let the words fall, watching her face. Suddenly Reggie sprang up, his cheeks crimson. "Enough, Poirot! You've said too much! Leave her alone!" There was a silence. Poirot turned to him, his expression almost tender. "Ah, so it is you, monsieur." Reggie stared, then sank back, his head in his hands. Poirot spoke quietly. "It was jealousy that killed Charles Linton. Not Wade's jealousy, as all supposed, but yours. You masked it in hearty good fellowship, but beneath it lay the truth. You loved Mademoiselle Glenn yourself, did you not? You could not bear to see her smile upon Linton." Reggie groaned. "I never meant—" Poirot raised a hand. "You walked with him into the lane under pretext of friendship. You quarrelled. The gardener heard you. Two men went down the road, but only one returned. You struck in passion, and afterwards you emptied his pockets clumsily to make it seem a robbery. but you forgot one thing. The watch left untouched. Reggie lifted his head, pale and stricken. I didn't plan it. I swear I didn't. I only meant to make him see, to make him give her up. We struggled. He fell. When I saw the blood... He buried his face in his hands. God forgive me. Violet Glenn uttered a cry, half anguish, half pity.
Reggie! Oh, you fool!
Poirot bowed his head. So Hastings, you see. The motive was not money, nor cards, but the old eternal story, the rival in love. In such matters, the little grey cells can only show what the heart already knows. The silence that followed was broken only by the crackle of the fire. Sir George looked solemn, Wade inscrutable, Violet Glenn shaken to her core. Reggie Frobisher sat like a broken man. At last Poirot sighed, smoothing his moustaches. The police will take their course. But for us, mes amis, the game is ended. The last card is played. And with that he turned away from the fire, his small figure suddenly weary, as though even the great Hercule Poirot felt the weight of the passions that drive men to folly. Epilogue. Return to Whitehaven. It was 2 days later when Poirot and I sat once more in our familiar sitting room at Whitehaven Mansions. The fog of the countryside had been replaced by the bustle of London, and I felt, for my part, greatly relieved to exchange the draughts of Wealdon Lodge for the comfort of our rooms. Poirot was engaged in polishing a pair of patent leather shoes until they shone like mirrors. He worked with delicate precision, humming softly through his nose. "Well, Poirot," I said, "it was not at all the case I expected. I was sure Wade was guilty. Everyone was sure of it. To think it was Reggie." Poirot smiled without looking up. "Always, Hastings, you pursue the hound that bays the loudest, but sometimes it is the quiet dog that bites." "Still," I mused, "I cannot help feeling sorry for the poor fellow. He was a decent chap, really, only carried away by his feelings."
"Precisely," said Poirot, holding up a gleaming shoe to the light. "It is the heart, not the head, that drives men to crime. Jealousy, it is like the worm in the apple. From outside, all is fair. Inside, it devours." I nodded, though uneasily.
"And Miss Glenn? Do you think she truly cared for Linton?"
Poirot's eyes twinkled. "Perhaps, mon ami, or perhaps she cared most for herself. Women, they are enigmatic creatures, but of this I am certain, she will forget more quickly than she imagines." He set down the shoes with satisfaction, and smoothed his moustaches. "As for you, Hastings, you should be warned. The cards, they are dangerous, not for the purse, but for the passions they reveal. Better stick to whist at the club, eh?" I laughed. "Perhaps you are right, Poirot, but I cannot promise never to sit down to a hand of poker again." "Then, monsieur, at least remember this. In cards, as in love, it is not the hand you hold that decides your fate, but how you play it." He leaned back, eyes half closed, the ghost of a smile on his lips. And I thought, as so often before, that Hercule Poirot could find philosophy in the polish of a shoe or the fall of a card, and somehow he was always right. And so concludes A Game of Hearts. A country weekend of cards revealed its final hand, not of fortune, but of jealousy, passion, and betrayal. This tale was written by us in homage to Agatha Christie, inspired by the real-life murder of William Ware, 1823, but imagined entirely anew in Poirot's world. Thank you for being part of this growing community. Your comments, your feedback, and the way you share these stories truly mean the world, and they are what keep Poirot and Hastings returning for the next case. If you'd like to support further, you can join our membership or leave a tip. But know that your presence here is already a gift. Until our next mystery, good night.